Okay, let's go ahead and start. Open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 12, please. We're glad that you are here. We've got visitors with us tonight. Thank you for your presence. In this quarter of Wednesday nights, we're working our way through the book of Joshua. And so we've made it to chapter 12. We're going to cover these three chapters tonight. And what we have tonight is summaries, more of a summary type of thing, and talking more about the land. We're not going to read every verse. We're not going to go through the detailed borders of each land allotment and that sort of thing. So we'll do some more summarizing tonight than we usually do. But talking about the land, they're in the promised land. They're conquering it. They're dividing it up. And, you know, sometimes we had detailed battles like Jericho, the first big one, the first one as they crossed the river, and then Ai after that. And then last week we talked about the five kings coming and attacking Gibeon and Israel defends. And so kind of detailed battles and stuff. So we don't have that tonight. It's a little different in these chapters. It's more of a summary of the things that were going on. And so it'd be slightly different from last week. In these first few verses in chapter 12, it talks about kings and lands conquered by Moses. So we're talking about stuff that's already happened back in the book of Numbers when Moses was still alive. Chapter 12 and verse 1, now these are the kings of the land whom the sons of Israel defeated and whose land they possessed beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise from the valley of the Arnon as far as Mount Hermon and all of the Arabah to the east. So again, this is talking about the land to the east of the Jordan River, which is the area divided up back in Numbers. You can read Numbers 32, where they're dividing all that up. The 2.5 tribes are going to settle on the east side. So we'll put some maps up here. Before Israel comes in, this is kind of what it looks like. You got all these different people groups, even if you can't read it from where you're sitting. A bunch of different people groups living in the land on the east and west. And then here comes Israel. They come up on the east side. They do some conquering over here. That's what we're talking about right now in chapter 12, is everything on this side of the river. So this is what it ends up looking like. Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh are settled on the east side of the river. So those 2.5 tribes. And you notice in Joshua 12:1 that it not only says they defeated the people in the land, but also that they possessed it at that time, which is different from later lands that it's talking about where they may have conquered it and then left. And then they might get re-inhabited or something, but they're not fully in possession of that land yet. Drop down to verse 6. Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the sons of Israel defeated them, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave it to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh as a possession. Okay, so now this is what it looks like here. It's going to look like this, where you have all 12 tribes spread out on the east and west of the river there, but we're not there yet. We're only partially there. Okay, so that's the way it starts out. And then the second part of chapter 12, kings and lands conquered by Joshua. Now, so first Moses, now Joshua. So now we're talking about this book, the book of Joshua, and what's happening here with Joshua as the leader. And Joshua 12 and verse 7, now these are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the sons of Israel defeated beyond the Jordan toward the west from Baal-Gad and the Valley of Lebanon, even as far as Mount Halak, which rises toward Seir, and Joshua gave it to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to their divisions. Okay, so notice the contrast to verse 1. The land of the east they already possessed, and then the land of the west that he's talking about here is given as a possession, but they don't actually live there yet. They haven't necessarily conquered all of those lands yet. It's not fully accomplished. In fact, skip ahead to 13:1. Now Joshua was old and advanced in years when the Lord said to him, "You are old and very advanced in years, and very much of the land remains to be possessed." So there's still work to be done, still battles to be had, still land to be possessed. But he's saying, here's where you're going to live, basically. This is what's going to happen. We're apportioning the land. This is going to be your allotment and so forth. So we're not going to read. Start just looking at verse 9 and kind of scan your eyes from Joshua 12:9 down through the end of the chapter. And it's just listing all the kings that they defeated. And then in verse 24, it says the king of Tirzah won in all 31 kings. So it's just listing 31 kings that they beat. There's not telling the stories of all of those guys, but here's 31 kings that they defeated. And then let me put a map up here. Wish this was a better map and different colors, but if you can kind of see how it's a different shade of yellow here, And then these other areas are a different little shade of yellow slash brown. I'll zoom in a little bit. But this is attempting to show, like, here's the land they already possess and are settled in. And then there's still a lot of land in there where they're not yet, they haven't yet conquered it, or at least they're not yet living there in these other sections of land. So even if you can't really see that from where you're sitting, the main point is they're not in full possession of the land yet. So we're talking in these chapters tonight about, okay, this is going to be Zebulun's land. This is going to be, you know, the different tribes' land. But they're not actually living there yet. There's still work to be done. Okay, so that is chapter 12, kind of summarizing a bunch of the kings they've already defeated. We're going to get into the land and its apportionment here. But that's chapter 12. Comments, questions on any of that so far?
The way that it's worded is interesting. It lists the kings as one, and this king, one, this king, one. And it makes me think of an accounting, like their God is balancing his checkbook, balancing his ledger, saying, I told you I would do this. I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this. And I have fulfilled I have kept my promise in minute detail.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And if you're keeping score, you're just marking the kings off that they're defeating there. And as we get to the end of Joshua, God's going to make it very clear, you know, I have fulfilled my promise to you. I promised you the land. Here's the land. All these promises have been fulfilled. And that's what we're reading about. You know, it's just the details of all of that happening. And also, you know, it distinguishes this text as legitimate and authentic in that it's not just saying very vaguely, you know, they fought a bunch of people and lived. It's like, no, here's the cities and the names of the kings that they defeated. This is the historical record of what happened. Okay, anything else? Chapter 12, Daniel?
I was thinking about this last Wednesday when we studied this, but there are a lot of kings in this land. It's not just one king like the Israelites will ask for later.
Right.
You know, it's kings in every city.
Yeah.
So what they had with the judges and with the prophets were what the land was like. They had leaders in each place, leaders of the tribes and things like that, but they wanted one king. And so it seems odd to me that there are so many kings. They're really basically just leaders over cities.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Lachish, so city-states or whatever that would have been called back then, a bunch of those kings over each of those cities, that's right. So like last week, we studied five kings from five cities that come and attack them, and of course, it's not enough because God's on their side. Okay, good. Anything else? Okay, look in chapter 13 then, where he's going to start talking about, again, Joshua's old. God says more land needs to be conquered. Joshua 13 and verse 1. Now Joshua was old and advanced in years when the Lord said to him, you are old and advanced in years, and very much of the land remains to be possessed. This is the land that remains. And then he just starts listing it. All the regions of the Philistines, those of the Geshurites, and so forth. Drop down to verse 6. All the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon, as far as Mizrepoth-Maim, all the Sidonians, I will drive them out from before the sons of Israel. Only allot it to Israel for an inheritance as I have commanded you. Okay, so he's giving instructions here. This is what you do. Oh, I meant to read verse 7. Now, therefore, apportion this land for an inheritance to the nine tribes and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Okay, so 2.5 on the east, 9.5 on the west to get your 12 tribes in. So Joshua, God is telling Joshua, go ahead and allot the land. But again, it's not fully under their control. He's saying it still remains to be possessed. But, of course, with God, it's as good as done. If they are faithful to God, he will continue to bless them and give them these victories, and the idolatrous people of the land will be defeated. Of course, we know when we get to the book of Judges, God is saying there are still people left in there, the Philistines and different ones that God has left. The reason, he says, is so that the next generations can learn war. They didn't have to go through all these battles. The next generation is going to have to do some of that, and they're going to learn from those lessons just like this generation had to do that. So God's going to leave some people there also, but generally speaking, they're going to go and conquer this land. And so the descriptions of the land are the descriptions of where they are going to live. You know, here's the land Asher's going to be in. Not yet, but when all is said and done, that's where you're going to be. And then in verses 8 through 33, listing of lands east of the Jordan, and Reuben, Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh, as we've been mentioning already. Verse 8, with the other half-tribe, the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses gave them beyond the Jordan to the east, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave to them. And this section just starts listing the boundaries of the land east of the Jordan. And so we're not going to read through all the details. It's just basically saying, okay, the border of this territory is from here, down to here, down to here, down to here, and describing the land in that way, which is good in that it shows us, again, the authenticity of the record. These are real places he's talking about. It's not just like a vague fairy tale type description. You know, it's like, here's the historical markers of where these territories were. Also helps when we're trying to do maps of figuring out where things were back then. Verse 13, but the sons of Israel did not dispossess the Geshurites or the Maacathites, for Geshur and Maacath live among Israel until this day. So notice again, not everyone was conquered at this time. There were still people living in the midst of Israel. And then verse 14, only to the tribe of Levi he did not give an inheritance. The offerings by fire to the Lord, the God of Israel, are their inheritance, as he spoke to him. Also skip down to verse 33 that also talks about Levi. But to the tribe of Levi, Moses did not give an inheritance. The Lord, the God of Israel, is their inheritance, as he had promised them. Okay, so the tribe of Levi was unique. You look at these maps in the back of your Bible, and you've got 12 tribes, but Levi is not there. And that's because they didn't get an allotment like this, like the other tribes did. Hold your place in Joshua. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 18, please. Just a quick reminder of why that was the case. God had chosen the tribe of Levi to serve him in a special way. And the priests of Israel were going to come from the tribe of Levi. In Deuteronomy 18 and verse 1, the Levitical priests, the whole tribe of Levi, shall have no portion or inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the Lord's offerings by fire and his portion. They have no inheritance among their countrymen. The Lord God, the Lord is their inheritance, as he promised them. Now this shall be the priest's due for the people, for those who offer a sacrifice, either an ox or a sheep, of which they shall give to the priest the shoulder and the two cheeks and the stomach. You shall give him the first fruits of your grain, your new wine and your oil, and the first shearing of your sheep. For the Lord your God has chosen him and his sons from all your tribes to stand and serve in the name of the Lord forever. Okay, so that's how the priests were provided for, was not that they had a big section of land that they can go out and do their own thing, although they did have cities with pasture lands around them. But they're going to be taking a certain portion from these offerings that are brought from the whole nation, which would have amounted to a lot if you try to calculate that out. Some people have, and that would be a lot of stuff if everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. If everybody's bringing the offerings like they're supposed to, if everybody's, if the Levites are getting the portion that they're supposed to, they would be well supplied. Now, as the centuries went on, that was not always the case. The Israelites did not always obey that. The Levites were not always taken care of like they were supposed to, but that was the system that God set up. That's the way it was supposed to work, but they often did not obey. Okay, so that's the Levites there. Just wanted to mention that. Anything about that so far? Okay, so next, if we go back to Joshua, the text records the allotments for the 2.5 tribes on the east. So it's going to talk about Reuben, verse 15, Gad, verse 24, half-tribe of Manasseh, verse 29. Let me put that map back up there as it's talking about those 2.5 tribes. Look in Joshua 13, 15. So Moses gave an inheritance to the tribe of the sons of Reuben according to their families. And then you can just kind of scan your eyes down to verse 16. Their territory was from Arior, blah, 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 and so forth. It's just describing that section of land. Notice, though, in verse 15, it's Moses. Moses gave this inheritance. So, again, we're talking about not what Joshua's done. This is what's already happened before. Talking about stuff that happened back in the book of Numbers. And then in verse 22, the sons of Israel also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, the diviner, and the sword among the rest of their with the sword among the rest of their slain. Okay, now why is Balaam mentioned in particular? Of all the people they're killing back then, they're conquering these lands. They're wiping out these people groups. Why is Balaam in particular mentioned? Go back to Numbers 22, Just a quick reminder of why this guy was such a thorn in the side of Israel and why he was in particular noted for his troublemaking, and his death is noted the way it is. Numbers 22 and in verse 5, this is talking about King Balak, 22:5. So he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Behold, a people came out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the surface of the land, and they are living opposite me. Now, therefore, please come, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." Okay, so this king, Balak, wants to get this prophet, Balaam, to curse Israel for him. So he takes him up to these different places, and he's offering him all kinds of money, you know, please curse Israel for him. And of course, God does not let Balaam curse Israel, no matter how much money is offered. And even though it seems like he really would like to please King Balak and do something and make some headway here, but God does not allow that to happen. Skip over to chapter 31, Numbers 31. And in verse 8, notice the last phrase of Numbers 31:8. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. Okay, so when they went fighting and slaughtering the Midianites, it mentions here that that's when Balaam was killed. But then notice a comment that's made. Drop down to verse 15. I'm still in Numbers 31, verse 15. And Moses said to them, "Have you spared all the women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord." Okay, so the interesting thing there is that phrase, through the counsel of Balaam. So we find out more now. Back in the story that started in Numbers 22, all we knew was that Balak was trying to get Balaam to curse Israel. God did not allow him to curse Israel. Find out later here in chapter 31, there was some counsel given from Balaam, something to do with these women that caused Israel to sin. And then if we go all the way over to the other end of our Bibles, Revelation 2, there's another comment made in Revelation 2:14 about Balaam. Revelation 2:14 says, "But I have a few things against you, because you have there some who hold the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit acts of immorality." Okay, so we put Revelation 2:14 and Numbers 31:16 together, and that shows us what evidently had happened back there. Apparently, Balaam had told King Balak, "Okay, God won't let me curse him. I can't get him that way. This is not going to be successful for you. But I'll tell you what you can do. If you can use your women to seduce the Israelite men into some sort of idolatry and fornication stuff like that, God will curse his own people." And so apparently that's what happened. And that's what we read about back in Numbers, is that they played the harlot and were with these women from the other nation, and therefore God sent a plague upon them. And that was apparently through Balaam's cunning advice. He did a workaround since God wouldn't let him directly curse the people of Israel. That's why he was such a thorn in Israel's side, is that he would do something like that to get at Israel. And so in Joshua, going back now to our text, in Joshua 13:22, of all the people who were dying back then, I suppose that's why his name in particular is brought up in Joshua 13:22, they had killed Balaam. He was notable as a particular troublemaker for Israel. Okay, let me pause there. Anything you want to say about Balaam or any of these other lands so far? Okay, notice in Numbers 13, or Joshua 13:24, Moses gave an inheritance to the tribe of Gad, to the sons of Gad according to their families. And then the next few verses describe that territory. And then in verse 29, Moses gave an inheritance to the half-tribe of Manasseh, and it was for the half-tribe of the sons of Manasseh according to their families. Okay, so that gets the 2.5 tribes on the east of the Jordan River, setting up these areas to be theirs. Okay, and then we're to chapter 14, where we have an explanation of the 9.5 tribes and the 2.5 tribes, and again, a few words about Levi. Look in Joshua 14 and in verse 1. Now, these are the territories which the sons of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the households of the tribes of the sons of Israel apportioned to them for an inheritance. Okay, so now we're reading about the land to the west of the Jordan, and you notice he's using the word Canaan there. This is the way the word Canaan is being used, at least in this verse, to talk about the land west of the Jordan, this promised land. And then in verse 2, he says, by the lot of their inheritance, as the Lord commanded through Moses for the nine tribes and the half-tribe. Notice that this is said to be given by lot, and that word keeps coming up through the book of Joshua, whether it's by lot or the casting of lots or the lot done before the Lord or some terminology like that. So you read that throughout the Bible, this idea of casting lots or drawing lots or something like that, which was a widespread practice in the ancient Near East. And we don't know exactly how they always did it, and it probably differed from culture to culture and maybe from time to time. But it evidently involves some sort of objects that I think of like rolling dice or something, but I don't know how close it was to dice, but some sort of tokens or bones or wooden pieces or stones or something that they have that they would cast in their lap or draw or something like that to determine a divine decision. Look in Proverbs chapter 16. And so I'm sure a lot of pagan groups back then would just do that, and you know, like today, reading tea leaves or something, and there's nothing to it. But in the case of God and his people, and what this is talking about, God would actually use this as a way to communicate and give his decisions on certain things. Proverbs 16 and verse 33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. So God would actually use this. It wasn't just like an old wives' tale or something. God would actually sometimes use this as a way of communicating his decision. Now, why did he do that? Be turning over to Acts chapter 1. Why did he do that? I have no idea. Just like a lot of things God did. Why did he choose this particular method? Couldn't tell you. It just says that sometimes he did. In Acts chapter 1, here's another example of that being used. When Judas had already killed himself, they're going to select another apostle to take his place. And they got two guys to make a choice from. In Acts 1 and verse 23, so they put forward two men, Joseph called Barsabbas, who was also called Justus, and Matthias. And they prayed and said, you, Lord, you who know the hearts of all men, show which one of these two you have chosen to occupy this ministry and apostleship from which Judas turned aside to go to his own place. And they drew lots for them, and the lot fell to Matthias. And he was added to the 11 apostles. So here's how Matthias was chosen as apostle. They prayed to God, they cast lots, and apparently God gave the response there. Okay, now go back to Numbers 22. That's just a little background on lots in general, the casting of lots. Back in Numbers, I meant to say Numbers 26. In Numbers 26, God had already commanded ahead of time that when it came time to divide up the land, which is the point in time that we're at, that they were to do so by lot. In Numbers 26 and in verse 55, but the land shall be divided by lot. They shall receive their inheritance according to the names of the tribes of their fathers, according to the selection by lot. Their inheritance shall be divided between the larger and the smaller groups. And so God is saying ahead of time, this is the way I want you to do it. Okay, now go forward to Acts chapter 13. This is centuries later, looking back to the time we're talking about. Acts 13, this is when Paul is talking about it, kind of doing a history lesson here. Acts 13 and verse 17, the God of this people Israel chose our fathers and made the people great during their stay in the land of Egypt, and with an uplifted arm he led them out from it. For a period of about 40 years he put up with them in the wilderness. When he had destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he distributed their land as an inheritance, all of which took about 450 years. Okay, so notice here that he distributed their land as an inheritance. This is attributing it to God. God's doing this. God's doing all this. God rescued them out of Egypt. God led them through the wilderness. God apportioned this land in Canaan. The reason why I'm stressing that is when we go back to our text in Joshua, not just in chapter 14, but in the next few chapters, where it keeps saying it's by lot, Joshua 14, 2, by the lot of their inheritance. Let's not have in our minds that they were just like rolling the dice, just luck of the draw, whoever got it. God was evidently doing this. And Paul comes along later and says, this was God controlling all of this, the apportioning of the land. It was not just luck of the draw here. God was in charge of the process. So the mentions of that throughout Joshua, let's just keep that in mind. Skip ahead to Joshua 18 and verse 6. You shall describe the land in seven divisions and bring the description here to me. I will cast lots for you here before the Lord our God. There's just another reference to this practice. They're casting lots before the Lord our God. Okay, let me pause there. Any comments, questions about casting lots, dividing up the land? J.D.?
I don't know if this is why he did it this way, but if he just gave one person the words, the names of the cities, no one else would know. Now, he has shown throughout history that he can verify the word of his prophets, but somebody could say, oh, you just picked that city. So worst case scenario, it's random. Or God is influencing the outcome of the lot casting, but
yeah.
At least if someone is jaded or doesn't have full faith in the spokesman for God, they could at least know in front of everyone that it's a fair lot that's been cast. And,
right, yeah.
And I don't know if we have a description of how exactly did it, but, you know, I would assume lots of people are there watching the casting of lots. Whatever the casting of lots look like, I guess they were there. The leaders from each tribe and so forth. Okay, anything else? Okay, look in verse 4, Joshua 14:4. For the sons of Joseph were two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, and they did not give a portion to the Levites in the land except cities to live in with their pasture lands for their livestock and for their property. Okay, so when you're talking about the sons of Israel, it's a slightly different list than the tribes of Israel. So the sons of Israel, remember how all this started was Abraham. God chose Abraham and said, your descendants, I'm going to make you a great nation. So you had Abraham, who had a son named Isaac, who had a son named Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. And then Israel had these 12 sons. So these are 12 literal sons, physical sons that the man Israel had. And then those sons have their families, which come to be the tribes of Israel. Although, as we've already talked about tonight, Levi does not get a section of land like the rest of them do, because they're going to be the priests, and God's got them sprinkled throughout the land in these 48 different cities. And then the other weird thing is Joseph, the tribe of Joseph, is divided up into two. His two sons were Ephraim and Manasseh, and so Joseph splits into two, Ephraim and Manasseh. So even if you take Levi out of the count, you still have 12 tribes in that sense. So just a slightly different thing to notice there between the sons of Israel and the tribes of Israel. Okay, and then this last section of chapter 14, Caleb wants Hebron, where the Anakim live, and Joshua gives it to him. This is a really neat section of text here. Let's take a look. Joshua 14 and verse 6, then the sons of Judah drew near to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, said to him, you know the word which the Lord spoke to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea. Okay, now just take a moment to remember. Go back to Numbers 13, please. Think about the history between these two guys that are talking, Caleb and Joshua. Back in Numbers 13 and verse 6, when they're going to spy out the land, and the order comes down, select one man from each tribe. So Numbers 13, 6, from the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. Verse 8, from the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun. That's Joshua. See in verse 16, these are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, but Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Okay, so you got Caleb and Joshua. That's two out of the 12 spies sent into the land. And then drop down to verse 30. After they've come back, it says, verse 30, Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. Okay, so notice that it's Caleb in verse 30 who's noted as he's the one quieting people down and he's making this stand of integrity and faith and courage, saying, yeah, we can do it. God said we can. Let's do it. Now, Joshua was also on his side, but he's not mentioned until chapter 14 and verse 6. But here, Caleb is the one singled out. He's the one taking a stand. Look in Numbers 14 and verse 22. 14:22. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers nor shall any of those who spurn me see it, but my servant Caleb, because he has had a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it." Okay, so God, who not only saw the outward display in chapter 13 of Caleb, but also knows the heart, he sees the inner Caleb, gives this high commendation and reward to Caleb. And Joshua, too, is also mentioned later on in the text there. But Caleb and Joshua, these two faithful spies. So chapter 14 and verse 30, "Surely you shall not come into land in which I swore to settle you, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun." And so God's punishment famously for Israel was for them to live in the wilderness for a total of 40 years. You see in 14:34, "According to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days for every day, you shall bear your guilt a year, even 40 years, and you will know my opposition." Okay, we know by comparing other passages that this 40 years was a total of 40 years since they left Egypt, not from the time he said it in Numbers chapter 14. So if you start counting and use year one, God starts with year one back here instead of zero, as we might conceive of it. So it goes from year one to year 41. Year one, month one, day 15 is when they left Egypt. Year 41, month one, day 10 is when they crossed the Jordan River. So within 5 days of being exactly 40 years that they were in total in the wilderness here. And so when they took the census in Numbers chapter 1, when they took a census, there were 603,550 men. And then Joshua and Caleb are the faithful ones that he said, these two will go into the land. Everybody else is going to die out in the wilderness. So if you think about those other 603,548 men, he said, your corpses will fall in the wilderness. The two men, Joshua and Caleb, enter into the promised land. Excellent story that we should always keep in mind. Stick with God, even if you're in the minority. And so back to our story then. In Joshua 14 and verse 6, now you've got these two faithful men. Think about the camaraderie these two guys have as they talk to each other again and the shared history that they have. The two oldest men in Israel, because they're the two survivors from their generation. Also, one other note. Did you notice it says, go back to our text now, Joshua 14. Caleb is not a native Israelite. He's a Kenizzite. Chapter 14 and verse 6. Son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite. Kenaz was a grandson of Esau. So he's a Kenizzite. So remember, you have the twin sons, Jacob and Esau. Jacob is Israel. So you got the Israelites and the Edomites is what Esau's people were called. So the Edomites and Israelites. And he was from this one over here. And so sometimes foreigners were welcomed into the nation of Israel, and they became assimilated into the nation of Israel. And apparently that's what happened with Caleb's family. You remember who else that happened to? It was Rahab, we read earlier. In Joshua 6:25, after they rescued her from Jericho, and she comes and she lives in the midst of Israel until this day, it says, Joshua 6:25. So in Numbers 13, Caleb was considered not just like a foreigner living there, but he's a leader in the tribe of Judah. He's the one selected as the spy for the tribe of Judah, representing them as a spy. And so I just think it's interesting. The Holy Spirit gives credit where it's due. Here's these two people born not as Israelites, Caleb and Rahab. And it says these two people had faith, Rahab and Caleb, even though they were not born as native Israelites. So appreciate that about the Holy Spirit. Joshua 14 and verse 7, "I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought word back to him as it was in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt with fear, but I followed the Lord my God fully. So Moses swore on that day, saying, 'Surely the land on which your foot is trodden will be an inheritance to you and to your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God fully.' Now behold, the Lord has let me live just as he spoke these 45 years from the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses when Israel walked in the wilderness, and now behold, I'm 85 years old today." Okay, just a quick note here. That gives us a time stamp. We can add that to our timeline here. Caleb is saying, "I was 40 years old back here when I was a spy, and I'm 85 years old right now." And so we do a little calculation here. These are round numbers. I wouldn't be too picky about this, but If he's 40 back here, 45 years now to here. If this would have been year two, so that tells us we're in year 47 down here. 45 years have passed, which also means that it's been about 6 years since they crossed the Jordan River. So that gives us a little bit of a rough estimate. Now, I don't know when his birthday was that year, you know, stuff like that. So I wouldn't be too argumentative about that. But that gives us a rough 5, 6, 7 years since they crossed the Jordan River, give or take a bit. So back in Joshua 11, 18, it just said Joshua was fighting these kings a long time, which is a very vague time reference. Here we get a little bit more of an estimation of that. And then let's finish the chapter here, Joshua 14 and verse 11. I am still as strong as I was in the day Moses sent me. As my strength was then, so my strength is now for war and for going out and for coming in. Now then, give me this hill country about which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day that Anakim were there with great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me and I will drive them out as the Lord has spoken. So Joshua blessed him and gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, for an inheritance. Therefore, Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, until this day because he followed the Lord God of Israel fully. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba, for Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. Then the land had rest from war. Okay, how awesome is that? How impressive is that? That Caleb comes along and so that's the land I want. The Anakim were described as a people great and tall, Deuteronomy 9 and verse 2. So these were the big guys. These were the giants. These are the ones that the spies went in. They saw people like this, and they said, we can't fight these guys. There's no way. We look like grasshoppers compared to these guys. And here comes Caleb, and Caleb is nothing but awesome. He's 85 years old, and he says, you know all the land I want? I want that land. I want the giants. I'll go fight them. I don't care if I'm 85 years old, and I'll whip them. I'm just as strong as I was when Moses talked to me when I was 40. And he goes in there and does it. Back in chapter 11, it already told us the Anakim were cut off. So think about Caleb. 45 years later, faith is still at the same high point. He said back in Numbers 13 and 14, we can go in there and defeat these people. God's on our side. 45 years later, he's saying the same exact thing. He hasn't lost his faith. In 14:12, you see the last phrase in 14:12, I will drive them out as the Lord has spoken. He doesn't care. He'll go fight them in his golden years, let's say. Okay, that brings us to the end of chapter 14. We got a couple minutes left to talk. Any observations you want to make, comments, questions? JD?
I love his reference to that promise to Joshua. He's like,
Yeah. You
were there when we heard God say, we hadn't hit 45 years yet. And his memory of that promise is so specific, and he's been looking for that specific fulfillment.
Yeah.
Not just the land in general. Like, I went to that city, and I said, and God said, I can have it. I'm going to have it.
It's not like he said, you know, he just had a good day back in Numbers 13 and 14, and then it waned over time. Well, maybe I was being overly optimistic. 45 years later, he's still raring to go. As old as he is, I'll do it. Give me that. Of all the land he could have picked, give me the land of the giants. I love it. Okay, anything else? Great examples here in conquering the land. Next time I teach, we'll talk about several chapters all at once because it's going to be more of this same sort of thing. Here's the territory, and it just kind of describes the territory. So we're not going to read verse by verse and get all that detail, but we'll kind of get the big picture as this land is being a portion. Wonderful time in Israel's history as God is fulfilling his promise. And we need to let that sink in. Thank you for your attention this evening.